On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
It's like birthday cake-flavored ice cream makes sense. I'm not sure boudin-flavored king cake makes any sense except to somebody who's got the most incredibly jaded palate.
Meet Miss Jamie Ross. She's a documentary filmmaker and Louisiana native, and she's got some strong opinions about a new kind of king cake that's infiltrating Mardi Gras celebrations. You know king cake, that sweet bread decorated with purple, gold, and green sugar. It's a New Orleans favorite this time of year, but a savory king cake seems to be stealing the show this time around, and Jamie Ross is not impressed. Thanks for joining us, Jamie.
Oh, I'm tickled.
So let's talk about the traditional cake first. The one I'm most familiar with is the one that's filled with cream cheese.
Oh, and actually that's an evolution from the original.
Which is?
The original king cake was more like a sweet bread dough. When I first moved to New Orleans, the only king cakes available were like that, and they were basically a sweet bread dough without the white icing, with green gold and purple, you know, sprinkles.
It had no filling at all.
It had no filling at all. We lived just down the street from McKenzie's Bakery, which was the big purveyor of king cakes. And their traditional one was just like that. It was basically a wreath-shaped sweet bread dough with, you know, the Mardi Gras colors of green, purple, and gold.
Wow, that's really interesting because that's much more like the sort of European breads that you see around Lent and Easter. When is it eaten and why? Is there a cultural significance to it?
The wonderful thing about Louisiana food, especially, is that it all revolves around community and sharing and people doing things together. So king cake is a lot like, you know, like gumbo or crawfish boils. You usually do it with a group of people. King cakes start being available around Epiphany, which is January 6th, the Day of the Three Kings. And they're supposed to be available until the day before Ash Wednesday, which is Mardi Gras. And during that time, people share them at offices and all kinds of places. And if whoever got the, used to be a bean or a pecan, now it's a baby, whoever gets that is supposed to bring in the one for the next day. I think traditionally, when it was more reserved for Mardi Gras crews, there was a tradition that whoever got the little prize, which was, like I said, a bean or a pecan or even maybe a little nugget of something, that then they would be the king or queen of the Mardi Gras ball or of the party, whatever. So
that sounds like a real upside.
Yeah, that's right.
So as we do, we love to push the envelope with food these days. Who started this new trend of making it more savory?
We can trace its beginnings to exactly a specific moment when there's a guy named Robert Carricker in Lafayette. He's done a great service to the community by creating a boudin trail where you can find the best boudin. And boudin is a wonderful, savory, spicy Louisiana sausage. And you usually eat it on French bread, or you eat it most of the times I've seen it eaten on saltine crackers. Anyway, this guy is an aficionado of both king cakes and boudin. He also has a king cakes review site. So he decided, why not merge the two? And so he came out with this boudin king cake, which not only has boudin in the middle of it, it is christened with Steen's ribbon cane syrup and crackling crumbs. And I don't know if you know cracklings are like little fried pork skins. So it is really combines three Louisiana traditions all in one concoction.
I've heard some folks say that this move to savory is kind of a misguided swerve into a hell of bad variations.
You know, it reminds me of something a friend of mine told her engineer studying son. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. So,
yeah, I don't know, the idea of crawfish king cakes and muffaletta king cakes.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one, too. I mean, it's a little bit, well, you know, it's funny. This guy was talking about how 60 to 70% of his sales are outside of Louisiana. So that should tell you that it's, you know, it's a curiosity. He claims that's homesick Louisianans. I don't think so. Because, you know, we ate one at my family. When we dug into it, we ordered one, and then we all gathered around and looked at this odd creature, and then we decided to have it. And what we ended up doing was just scraping the boudin out the middle and eating the boudin, to be honest, because that was the best part.
That's so funny. So yes. is there still the green, purple, and the gold sugar on the outside?
Well, we actually bought two, yes. One of them was the deluxe model with the green, purple, and the gold sugar on the outside, along with the steam syrup. And the other one had kind of a praline thing going on with the cracklings. So none of us were brave enough to tear into the green, purple, and gold one. So I think that got taken to the nursing home or someplace, honestly, so for the next day.
When I was preparing to talk to you, I was looking at a bunch of images, and I actually saw a photo of king cake sweet potato fries.
Wow.
So they were sweet potato fries that had like a drizzle of cream cheese on it and the sugar. Do you think that it's possible that this tradition is being too thoroughly mined?
I think, you know, it's what happens. You know, things evolve, but this is kind of like a forced marriage, I guess. I go back and forth because, you know, king cake, as we just talked about, has been evolving since the beginning. But this does seem a little bit taking it a little bit over the top. You know, when I get, as they say in South Louisiana, an envie for king cake, I want just a king cake that's maybe at most like got a little bit of cinnamon and sugar in it. You know, I've never been a fan of the Danish ones. That's to me what speaks of tradition and place and people. And the other things are fun, but I don't know whether they're going to stand the test of time. Did you also see the king cake vodka? Somebody sent me a picture of that.
Oh my goodness. Jamie, thank you so much.
You are so welcome.
Jamie Ross is a filmmaker making a documentary about the mixing and melding of African, Native American, and European cultures, especially foods, in the American South. Want to take a stab at making your own king cake, the traditional sweet kind, that is? Ann Kirk from Little Doms has shared her recipe. Find it on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. The Big Easy is the birthplace of so many cocktails. The Sazerac, the Hurricane, the Ramos Gin Fizz, and the Hand Grenade. Our friends at the Southern Food Alliance's Gravy Podcast looked into the origin of this wickedly strong neon green drink. Here's Ryan Furkel.
Take a walk down Bourbon most any time of the day, and you'll see legions of drinkers marching up and down the street with foot-long, neon green, grenade-shaped plastic Collins glasses in hand. This is the Hand Grenade, a mind-blurring cocktail sold at a local chain of bars called the Tropical Isle, where it's marketed as New Orleans' most powerful drink. It is the drink that might immediately come to mind when a Bourbon Street hater spouts something like this.
The constant night roar of the kids of Bourbon Street, pierced by rebel yells in the city they call the Big Easy, Swilling Boone's Farm, grabbing flesh, the sound of it all, an overwhelming din of screaming crowd, tinkling doubloons, crunching glass, and the rising orgasmic blare of 1,000 horns trembling the ancient brick walls in a jubilant apocalypse. Sid Moody, 1972.
The Hand Grenade has been celebrated in rap lyrics and lionized by sometime New Orleanian Nicolas Cage as Dennis Hopper Courage Juice, strong enough to make any writer uneasy. And though the drink just celebrated its 30th anniversary, its roots extend back to Bourbon's golden age.
Well, you know, in Mississippi at the time, you could get a driver's license at 15.
This is Earl Bernhardt. Back then, he was a young boy in Jackson, Mississippi. Now he is known as the unofficial mayor of Bourbon Street. Not many people can recall the details of their first time on Bourbon, but Earl sure can. It was the day he got his driver's license, the night he stole the family car.
And we said, hey, let's slip off and go to New Orleans. We can get back before Dad gets home and he'll never know we went.
15 years old and feeling free, that was Earl.
Well, the first thing we did was go to Pat O'Brien's and get a hurricane. And by about 3 o'clock that afternoon, I was hugging a light pole. And of course, I lost my brand new driver's license for, seems like, I think 6 months, and just really got in a world of trouble with my dad. But, you know, if I had it to do over again, I'd do it again. It was fun.
I learned my lesson, Earl told me. A lesson in responsibility, I asked. No, he laughed. I knew right then, one day, I had to be down on Bourbon Street running a place. Earl worked for years as a radio disc jockey, but kept his vow to return to New Orleans as a bar owner. His shot came in 1984 at the New Orleans World's Fair.
A friend of mine that was a college roommate, I happened to be down here visiting with his family, and they said, why don't we get a concession at the World's Fair? And I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. And anyway, we ended up getting a daiquiri concession at the fair.
Earl took a leave of absence from his broadcasting job and came down in New Orleans to run the daiquiri booth, called the Tropical Paradise.
That's where I met my current partner, Pam Fortner. She came to work as a bartender at the fair.
We could do strawberry daiquiris, banana daiquiris, margaritas, but only two mixed drinks, either a screwdriver or a Bloody Mary.
Pam was from Nashville. She had lived in New Orleans, tending bar for a decade.
I had to work in the daytime. I was not fast enough to work at night. There were these 18, 19-year-old bartenders who could pick up blenders and the drink was made. It was incredible.
At the fair, Pam and Earl met people from the world over. 6 months of spinning blender-made daiquiris at the Tropical Paradise.
We were right under the monorail at the entrance to the Italian Village, right across from the jazz tent. It was really a good location. People waited in line in the 100-degree weather for up to an hour to get on the monorail. They were riding around for 45 minutes, and then when they got off the monorail, they came out right by a frozen drink concession. It was like built-in success.
I think there's a lot of people who remember all this. It was just a fantastic thing for the city. It was the beginning of a resurgence in the city.
The 1984 World's Fair, though, was a financial disaster. The only World's Fair to declare bankruptcy while still open. It lost over $100 million. But Earl's little piece of paradise beat the numbers. It was one of the top three grossing concessions. He decided to stay in New Orleans. Earl partnered with Pam to lease a space at 738 Toulouse, located not quite on Bourbon, but just steps away. They called it the Tropical Isle.
You know, people think just because it's Bourbon Street, if you open up, the business is going to flow in, and that's not true. You have to have an angle, something to draw the people in.
So Earl and Pam decided they had to come up with something.
So every Saturday, Friday, and Saturday, we'd look toward Bourbon Street, and everybody was carrying a hurricane. And we said, we have got to tap into that market.
Earl says that over several weeks, they mixed and stirred, aiming for a recipe to rival the potency and popularity of the hurricane. They agreed on a mix of vodka, grain alcohol, gin, and melon liqueur, served over crushed ice. Pam tells a different story.
When we first started, the drink was the Tropical Itch.
The Tropical Itch, an old-school tiki punch made with rum and passion fruit and served with a swizzle stick that doubles as back scratcher.
So we went to the store to buy the back scratchers. So we were wandering around, and we looked, and there were toy hand grenades. They were gray, but, you know, they're toy. You're in the Mardi Gras store where beads are sold. So we said, oh, wow, we ought to make up a drink to go with that.
And 30 years later, the hand grenade is Bourbon Street's most ubiquitous drink. And, though there is no way of measuring this, arguably the city's best-selling cocktail. And it all started, at least according to Pam, with a toy hand grenade. But Earl is sticking to his story.
Okay, Pam, get Tropsy to give us the last secret ingredient as we invent the hand grenade. Here we go. Hey, we've done it. We invented the hand grenade.
That commercial that you just heard plays on local television stations and on a loop in several of the tropical isles. Earl has made dozens of commercials worthy of a half hour of YouTube surfing. He's trademarked the name Hand Grenade, offers a $250 reward for tips to catch offenders, and has taken action against hundreds of bars nationwide. an inflatable hand grenade man, dances on the corner of Bourbon and Orleans. When a new trend hits or rebounds, Earl is there.
We've come up with a skinny version, which is a lower sugar for people on a diet or diabetics or whatever. Of course, diabetics probably shouldn't drink, but I do. I do. We even have a hand grenade flavored condom, which gets a lot of laughs. People will buy them to take home as a joke. I don't know how many people actually use them. I don't ask that question. It's kind of embarrassing.
So basically, the Tropical Isle covers everything you need for a successful night on Bourbon Street. But does the hand grenade guarantee an authentic New Orleans experience? This is a sugar bomb of a drink, after all, served in a plastic toy cup. And the drink itself, it's kryptonite green and looks completely unhealthy to consume. In fact, the Tropical Isle's website strongly suggests that it is unsafe to drink more than a couple hand grenades. This drink is as far from the Sazerac or Ramos Gin Fizz, both well-respected, locally invented cocktails, as you can possibly get. So I asked Pam and Earl, is Bourbon Street authentic?
I can't say Bourbon Street is all New Orleans. It's just part of the whole picture. You know, New Orleans is quite a complicated place and a lot of stuff to see. Bourbon Street is part of the overall New Orleans experience.
When I grew up, I didn't know Catholics. I didn't know Jews. I didn't know Irish people. I was mid-America. So in that way, this is a melting pot. People resent Bourbon Street, and they shouldn't. You don't have to come here, but it's here if you want to come. And it's just an excitement, a nighttime excitement.
Pam is right. Take a walk down Bourbon Street most any time of day, and you'll see one of our nation's great democratic spaces. You'll see people of all ages, genders, races, origins, enjoying themselves. Many will be holding hand grenades, sometimes two hand grenades, taking selfies with their hand grenades, doing lascivious things with their hand grenades, drinking this most ludicrous of cocktails on this most vulgar of streets might just be the city's most authentic of rituals.
Today's seemingly inauthenticity is tomorrow's authenticity. So why don't we just cut out that transitional phase and realize that this is honest to goodness, real, legitimate part of the New Orleans story today.
Thanks to Gravy and the Southern Foodways Alliance for that homage to the hand grenade. It's the Market Report next. Stay close.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. What does it mean to be a modern master sauce maker? Do we need to know how to make the Escoffier canon, even if a rich sauce espagnole isn't in our wheelhouse? Well, not according to Susan Volland. Her book, Mastering Sauces, is an epic dive into sauce making that's relevant for the food we want to eat today. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Evan.
You know, I can't remember the last time I looked at the outside of a book and expected one thing and then opened it up and got something completely different.
Yeah, definitely. Most of the books tend to start with, or sauce books or sauce lessons, start with the French mother sauces. They start with giant vats of bubbling veal stock. They start with variances of roux. They start with a lot of eggs and a lot of butter. And I don't think that's the way contemporary cooks actually prepare sauces anymore. So I backed it up a little bit and decided that the three fundamental elements that cooks all over the world use to make sauces are, one, they maximize flavor, which means you start with really good ingredients and you understand how to maintain those flavors. Two is manipulate texture, which is so important with sauce making. And then three is season confidently, which I think is a tricky thing to remind people about. But they need to season, you need to season to your tastes.
I find when I teach that trying to convince people that they can teach themselves how to season confidently is one of the hardest things. And you have a fantastic exercise in the book to help people learn how to identify flavors. Can you take us through that?
Well, it relies on something that is very touchy right now, which is the fundamental tongue map. And there's a lot of sensory scientists that are discrediting that, but I still stand by it. And that is that there are regions in the tongue and the palate that distinguish the five elemental tastes most strongly, which are salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and the fifth taste, umami, which is a savory taste. If I can't get the subtleties of aroma and perfume, I have to rely on what I'm feeling for. And that is understanding the different regions of my palate and my tongue. So what I did was a test of creating samples, individual samples. This is how I illustrate it in classes. You have one that is salt water, one that has a little citric acid or maybe some vinegar in it, one that is sweet, one with a little bit of MSG or soy sauce, and bitters a little trickier, but you can use really strong tea or maybe some cocktail bitters. And then everybody gets a chance to taste that, swirl it around their mouth, and see how there are particular triggers. And once you get a feel for those triggers, then when you taste one of your sauces, you can recognize if it's very isolated in one spot, if it's empty in the front, if it's a very late aftertaste, and you can start to manipulate those finishing seasonings by getting a feel for how the sauce is.
It must be fascinating to show people all of this with just water as the base and have them realize how fundamental these tastes are.
Well, one of my favorite things is that at the end of the sample, you take a little spoonful of every single one of those samples, and then you mix it together and you taste that, and you realize how incredibly satisfying in so many ways this plain water is, and also connect that with a lot of the processed foods that we try and realize how much they rely on those tastes and the salt and the sugar and the acidity rather than the flavor, the difference between real chicken broth and chicken stock or chicken base. It's remarkable when you see how satisfying those tastes are, but then you have to introduce flavor.
So let's introduce flavor. And I have to say, here in Southern California, many of us are big farmers market shoppers. So the section of your book all about turning whole foods into sauces without adding thickeners is kind of fascinating.
One of the considerations is that when you're at the farmer's market, you don't just have to think about the sauces that will go on your fruits and vegetables, but you can think about how to turn those fruits and vegetables into sauces for other foods. And because there's so many natural elements, that textural elements in those particular ingredients, you need to kind of understand them a little bit, understand how to manipulate that flavor, and then get that really good, fresh, interesting salsa or puree or pesto.
Okay, so chimichurri.
Chimichurri that I've always been served in this country has always been just shamrock green. It's super, super bright green. It is sometimes compared to pesto, and it is aromatic and fresh and very parsley heavy and often extremely chili laced. It's often a little bit hot and very pungent with fresh garlic. And that was exactly not what I had in Argentina. What we had in Argentina was often red, tinged red, but not with hot chilies. It usually was kind of army green. It was heavy on oil, but it was more infused oil rather than the pungency of raw garlic. I'm not going to in any way proclaim that what I've had here is better or lesser than what I had in Argentina. It's just the evolution of how we cook.
So you take us on a trip in your book, sort of using the more familiar parsley-laced chimichurri that we're familiar with, and you kind of take us around the world with different flavors. Could you riff on that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a section on green sauces in that same vein of using farmers market ingredients, because pesto, of course, is, you know, basil pesto. Pesto Genovese is, of course, best in the middle of summer, and the basil is great. But the green sauces in the book are all over the map. There's like a bacon and parsley, warm bacon and parsley sauce. There's a nettle and avocado sauce. It's that seasonal, see what you've got, understand the texture, and then be creative and manipulate the seasoning and the flavors, and then use it the way that sounds good to you.
Well, Susan, it's what a pleasure to meet you, and what a wonderful legacy you've given us with this book. I'm going to be spending hours with it, I'm sure.
Well, hopefully it is more of a warm friend than a legacy. This is meant to be something that you feel comfortable with and confident and creative with and not necessarily intimidated by. So that's my hope. Fingers crossed.
Oh, I think you made it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Susan Volland. Her book is Mastering Sauces. Be sure to check out the Good Food blog for a recipe from the book. Let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She's there now with her weekly report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Stan Waitman is here at the market with a cart loaded with citrus, strawberries, gorgeous things. Stan is partners with Valerie Gordon. Valerie is well known for her fine chocolates, for her pastries, for her beautiful cookbook, and for now opening a storefront downtown at Grand Central Market. Stan is here, you're shopping, Stan. Tell us what you're sort of inspired by today and what Valerie's going to be cooking up.
So today we've got kumquats. We're getting kumquats today from Murray Farms. And those are actually going to be candied for an event that's being coordinated with Lucky Peach at Grand Central Market. So we're going to be doing chocolate-dipped candied kumquats. That's probably the most exciting thing that we have going on today. I mean, it's such a great time for citrus. Everywhere you go, everyone's citrus is so beautiful, but also so different. I've tried blood oranges from four different people today. We're getting some blood oranges today from Mud Creek Ranch. They've got a great color. They're not as sweet as some of the other ones, but the acid is really good, and it's got just a great rich flavor and a great red color. We use the juice to color different things in our line, and we'll candy the peel. So it goes to a lot of different uses, and sometimes it ends up in the cafe, and sometimes the fruit ends up in a jar. You know, we end up putting up preserves.
And you're down, I see you here all the time shopping. Valerie's obviously back creating recipes, cooking, and being inspired on that end.
Well, we have a unique situation. We have two kids. They're 8 and they're 4 now, August and Gigi. And so one of us has to get them to school in the morning. There's a lot of lugging around at the market, so I'm usually the one to do the lugging. So there's always a lot of coordination. I'm on the phone with her when I'm at the market, sometimes 5-10 times, looking at prices for different items, looking at, you know, something new that I found, you know, oh, you know, Mud Creek has users this week. Do we need some? Do you want to do anything with it? And what I'll do, though, a lot is I'll bring back samples. Somebody's got great new kumquats that I hadn't seen the week before, or the flavor softened. It's not as tart. It's a little bit sweeter, and it's really beautiful. I bring them back. I label what it is. I label where I get it. And then she gets to play with it a little bit and see, you know, what she wants to do with it.
Give us another example of something that's just so unique to this market.
Well, one thing that's great that's just coming back at Mud Creek Ranch is the bergamot. I first saw it, I think, 3 seasons ago, and it's not a super long season. But we do a lot. We do a lot with tea, and bergamot is an element of a lot of the Earl Grey. Last year, we put up a bergamot rhubarb marmalade. That's just amazing. Really, really unique flavors. And the kind of thing that she does really well, where it's flavor combinations that you wouldn't really think that you wouldn't think of, that I wouldn't think of.
All right. Well, Stan, it's so great to talk to you and see your gorgeous cart all loaded up here with all kinds of interesting vegetables as well. And look forward to following you around on another day. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Laura. Come visit us.
That was Stan Waitman, and he is Valerie Gordon's partner. They own 2 cafes and a confection business, and super inspired by the market and always here to help out the farmers. Margarita Smith is a farmer's daughter at Mud Creek Ranch. You have such a wide selection of citrus fruit. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, about your kumquats and about the bergamot? I think you're the only farmer that grows the bergamots.
In California, I do believe we are. It's just for the weather here, it's really hard to grow them. And the trees that we have, luckily, took a long time ago, and now they're just really hardy old trees. And then with kumquats, I mean, there's about 10 varieties, and I think we grow about 6 of them, and they all have different sweetness levels in the inside, and then the peel, too, tends to be more bitter, less bitter, sweeter. We're getting into, like, grapefruits, too, and pomelos, which are ancestor of grapefruit. And with all the different varieties of those, some are meaty, some are more juicy, some are like super sweet, almost tastes like a margarita. And then some are like extremely floral, pretty colors too, like the Chandler Pomelo that is like this vibrant pink purple color on the inside. And then also we have the Rex Union grapefruit, which is a hybrid of Seville orange, which is traditional marmalade fruit, bitter orange, and a Shattuck Pomelo. So it's like the perfect fruit to make marmalade with.
And you must be the only person that grows those too.
I think we are right now. UC Riverside just came up with them a little, or released them a few years ago. And yeah, so right now we have about 20 trees, 25.
What's so interesting is your dad, Steve, he is just constantly, like a kid in a candy store, buying more trees, right? And planting them and seeing how they turn out?
Constantly, like a kid at a candy shop.
So he will grow these then and fruit them out and then report back to the breeders or to the UC system and tell them how it produces?
Yeah, it's mainly with UC Riverside. Sometimes with new nurseries, or not new nurseries, but when nurseries come up with new fruit, they usually select about 5 regions in California with different soil and climate. And we get selected for the most part whenever they have new product coming out. And we'll grow it for 5 years just about and tell them if it was like hardy during the frost season or like if it was drought tolerant, how much it yield, the best soil it grew in. We do all the research on that.
Are you able to provide tangerines year round?
Yes. And that's one of the beautiful things with where our farm is in Southern California. It's a better natural cold storage for the fruit to leave it on the tree rather than just packing it all and putting it in a packing house.
It's so much fun to look at your stand and talk to you because there is just a stunning variety of fruit here. So thank you so much for all you and your family do.
Thank you.
That was Margarita Smith, and she is the daughter of Robin and Steve Smith. They have a farm in Santa Paula, and they grow 200 varieties of citrus alone, in addition to numerous other crops. So always a fun time to stop by the Mud Creek Ranch booth here at the Wednesday Market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
The bergamots at Mud Creek Ranch will only be around for a few weeks, so arrive early and stock up. In a minute, we delve into the controversial terrain of tipping and paid sick leave at restaurants. Stay with us.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Tipping. I say get rid of it. But this, of course, is massively controversial. So over the past year, we've seen restaurants get creative, from adding a 3% healthcare surcharge to extra tip lines for kitchen staff. In New York, restaurateurs Danny Meyer and Andrew Tarlow have been praised for going tipless. Revolutionary, right? Well, sort of. The tipless debate has a long history, and here to give us some perspective is Michael McCarty, owner of Michael's Restaurants in Santa Monica and New York. Hello, sir.
How are you, Evan?
So what do they say? The more things change, the more they stay the same?
And come d'habitude. Exactly.
So what year did you open Michael's?
Actually, April of 1979.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, 37 years.
Yeah, in April is coming up.
And when you opened, did you start with a service charge?
No, the way I opened was, you know, remember, this was the pioneering era of many functions, not just food, but service, decor, music, legal in the restaurant business, you know, labor relations. This was all beginning to start to gel as the next generation of how one operates restaurants. So having worked in Paris and, had been involved in a couple of restaurants over there. They have obviously the service compris, which is completed, included service. And in some cases, it was in the price of the menu item. And in others, it was just they added a percentage. But it was both formats. But at any rate, the custom was not to tip. You always left a few centimes at the end there if you had particularly good service. So when I opened Michael's here, one of the many things that we pioneered there was a revamp of the service system. One of the biggest problems with the restaurant business at the time was the incredible animosity between the front and the back of the house. Remember, my opening team was Ken Frank and Jonathan Waxman, Mark Peel, Nancy Silverton, Billy Flug, Sally Clark. I mean, it was a lineup to beat the band the first 5 or 6 years. So there was a reason why people were coming to the restaurant, not necessarily for the service, but in addition to the service, they were coming because of the food revolution that was happening at the time. So I said, okay, look it. I'd heard about a thing called a tip pool. Now, tip pool is a sharing of all the gratuities at the end of the night, and there's basically formulas that divide it up as to who get what's where and how. You know, the waiters get the most, runners get 2/3, and the busboys would get a half, and a sommelier would get a same waiter share as would a bartender. But I introduced something new to that. I sat down to everybody and said, listen, this kitchen is fantastic, and we should really be cutting some ground in this particular thing. So can we set it up where we can have 10% of the tip pool go to the kitchen every night? And everybody said, yes, that's fantastic. So that's what we did.
And then?
Flash forward about 6 months. The restaurant got a shitload of press. Excuse me for saying that, but you know what I mean. And somebody from the labor department came by and said, we are going to do our traditional audit here. And so we were audited, which is a normal thing. And they came up and they said, what is this line item on these all the kitchen staff? They have a gratuity. I said, well, listen, I think this is revolutionary. We have them included into the program. And the lady said to me, he says, that's illegal. And I said, what? I said, yes, it's illegal. So we got busted. I had to pay back that 10% to all the wait staff for those 6 months. Now, that's one of my opening salvos. So I said to her, I said, what can we do to include the kitchen? It's too important. And she says, well, you can do a service charge.
What was the response of the customer to the service compris?
Voila. Okay, so just to make a long story short, I did that in Denver at the Rattlesnake Club in 1985, the Rattlesnake Club in Detroit with Jimmy Schmidt in 1988, Adirondacks in Washington in January of 89, and Michael's in New York of November of 89. All had the service charge. We had a very efficient staff that could explain it, and they were taken care of and they were satisfied. Did they make the same amount of money, when I'm talking to this, of the waiters, as they would in a restaurant? No. But did they make more than enough? They did. And was it was sort of the group effort that made it work. But the customer still, every night, you can't tell me what to dip here. You can't do that, Nat. So we had the macho thing that went on here and there. But all in all, I think it was really good until the recession of 92.
How long ago did you abolish it?
That was in 95. As I said, the recession kicked in 92, you know, with the riots after the verdict for Rodney King. And then we had the fires and the earthquakes and the mudslides. And we had the aerospace industry collapse, the construction industry collapse. And we followed it up with the OJ was the end. That was sort of the bookmark. And January of 1995, I hired Sang Yoon and David Rossoff to be my new team. We dug our way out. We survived those 2.5 years. And first thing I sat down with those guys was I said, listen, what do you think we need to do amongst many things to take Michael's into the next generation? And they said, get rid of the service charge.
And one thing that I haven't heard people talk about also in this new discussion is the tax credit that the owner gets on tips. Because right now, the owner will pay tax, payroll tax.
Their employer share.
Their employer share on money they never see.
Right. FICA and unemployment taxes, yes.
Right.
And that's what the IRS gives you back as a tip credit. But again, to go back a little bit, we remember many things are based on your annual revenue. Most importantly, your insurance policies. So I was able to get the insurance companies to ignore my service charge because it, in fact, was something that no other restaurant was doing. So only charge me my premiums on my food and beverage sales, just like workman's comp. You see, it's the same thing. You know, this is what's also coming up out of the woodwork. People are realizing that, number one, all of your sales, especially when you do the formula where you're building in the price of the gratuity or the service into the menu item, well, there you have no choice. All of a sudden, everything else that you do, insurances, workman's comp, liability, anything that's based on your sales is going to go up by that equal amount, 20, 30%. And you're not going to get the tip credit the government would give you back on the unemployment.
So that's the downside of the all-in model.
People aren't realizing it. They're being more philosophical than reality. And that's why you see some of these restaurants that are falling, you know, back off the wagon on that. It was the right way. You know, there's no question. To establish the parity between the front and the back of the house was the key thing that drove this. But it's too early right now.
So you're in this really interesting position of having a restaurant in California and having a restaurant in New York.
Right.
States which have quite different minimum wage.
Yes.
Right now, it's $10 going up to $15 in the next couple of years.
Right.
And in New York, how much is it?
Well, it was – California is one of the six or seven or eight states that don't have a tip credit. What that means is that you're supposed to make sure that your waiter makes minimum wage. Well, when they're making $200 a night, they're clearly making minimum wage. So you are entitled to pay them in New York City up until January 1st. It was $5 an hour. So they made $5 an hour for all their hourlies, and, you know, they would still go home with $65,000, $70,000 a year. You see what I'm saying? So they clearly made the minimum wage. That $5 an hour as of January 1st in New York City went up to $7.50. That's a 50% increase. That's an automatic $250,000 expense that my restaurant in New York would have had last year if it had been the same and will have this year. Now, we talk about razor-thin margins. That's an extraordinary thing, and that money is, again, going to people that are making sometimes double what people in the kitchen are making.
But in New York, there is a tip credit, right?
There is. Oh, I'm just saying, it was at five. Now it's at $7.50.
Are you going to go back to a service charge?
No. This is good fodder for the press right now, and it should be. I do not believe, again, it's the same problem in 1979 as it is today. I don't believe that the American customer is ready for it. To go and to stake to my restaurant right now and increase my prices by 25 to 35%, it can't happen. Just can't happen.
You know, it's what's so interesting, too, to me is that we're having this conversation. We're talking about a high-end sliver of restaurants.
Absolutely.
And I think about what's going to happen to the neighborhood diner.
Oh, they can't add 35%. You know, and when they were talking about Danny Meyer in New York and increasing his prices, it's not 15 or 20%. To do all the stuff to get back to even, like we talked about with the insurance premiums and the no longer the tax on the unemployment rebate and just the whole nine yards, you're talking 35%. And to me, in an a la carte world, in a high-end city, yes, you can do that. And all the little funny things, by the way, you know, like the little 3% this and the 5% that, you know, legality is extremely important. And there's a lot of problems with doing that. I mean, the service charge is no longer legal in both New York and L.A. You can't do that. I mean, look at the lawsuits that several of the big restaurant chains in New York City went through, $6 million because they withheld the service charges. You know, it's a very difficult time right now legally to be doing all of this. And if you could go back to 1979, if you could include the kitchen in the tip pool and everybody did it, then you satisfy all your little minimum wages and everything like that, and everybody is on a parity. They're on a level playing field. Now, the state has ruled in a couple of cases saying that's okay to do. The feds still haven't. That's why no one's doing it. But to me, there's a balance, you know, and what's happening here is it's getting out of balance.
What a disruption for the industry.
It is.
Yeah.
But it's great for conversation.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, my dear.
That was Michael McCarty. He has two restaurants, Michael's in Santa Monica and New York. Chipotle is trying to dig itself out of an absolute PR nightmare after E. coli and norovirus outbreaks sickened dozens of its customers last year. To help prevent future outbreaks, the Mexican fast food casual chain says it's going to tighten up its food safety measures and offer paid sick days to employees. This got us thinking, how many restaurants have paid sick days as part of the benefit package? Just the term benefit package is laughable at many restaurants. We posed this question to Saru Jayaraman. She's one of the founders of Rock United and runs the UC Berkeley Food Labor Research Center. Thanks for joining us, Saru.
Thank you for having me.
How common are paid sick days for restaurant workers?
90% of restaurant workers in America do not have a single paid sick day 2/3 report cooking, preparing, and serving our food when they are ill, with everything from H1N1 to typhoid fever to, oh gosh, we've had workers working with hepatitis. I mean, just such a wide range of issues.
Do any, aside from Chipotle, which we now hear is about to offer this to employees, are there any other large chains who do?
In-N-Out Burger does offer paid sick days. And of course, the state of California requires 3 paid sick days. That legislation was passed just last year, but it's not enough. And definitely, there are plenty of restaurants that still do not offer it, even though the state law requires it.
I think there are probably a lot of restaurateurs who don't even know about it.
That don't even know. That's right.
Are there any cities that are requiring paid sick days at restaurants?
The city of San Francisco is the oldest city in the country, actually, to guarantee 9 paid sick days to all workers. And city of Oakland actually just passed a ballot measure requiring 9 paid sick days as well. So several cities in California and around the country, several states are moving in this direction, requiring it. But we do see still rampant noncompliance, rampant, as you said, ignorance of the law, both on the part of employers and on the part of workers. And what really makes it more difficult is our industry's informal and, challenging culture of tipping and shifts. So, you know, in most states in the United States, not California, workers are allowed to receive a lower minimum wage. In fact, the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the United States is just $2.13 an hour. So most workers in America who are tipped employees actually don't earn a base wage at all because their wages are so low they go completely to taxes and they're living off their tips. And when you live off your tips, even if you have a paid sick day, you often will go to the restaurant because you know the only way to actually earn a wage is to make that money in tips, is to get it from customers. And so there's this whole culture in our industry of feeling like, well, even if I'm sick, even if I have a paid sick day, I'd prefer just to go to work because I know I can actually earn my income only by going to work and making money in tips. And the only real solution is not just guaranteeing paid sick days, which is critical, but also getting restaurant workers to a livable wage paid by their employer that allows them to not be so dependent on customer tips to feed their families.
Are there any statistics that you know of on estimated foodborne illness due to lack of paid sick days?
Well, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, reports that 50 to 90% of all norovirus outbreaks, and if you don't know what norovirus is, you probably don't want to know. It's also known as the winter stomach flu. It's pretty horrible. 50 to 90% of norovirus outbreaks can be traced back to sick restaurant workers. The CDC did another study where they surveyed something like 500 restaurant workers nationally and found that 11%, so more than 1 in 10, actually had extreme vomiting and diarrhea on the job, and that was twice as likely if they didn't have a paid sick day. So, I could go on and on. There's many other instances. You know, the Olive Garden, for example, in 2014, the Olive Garden received an award from Michelle Obama for providing healthy food for kids, and in the same moment they got that award, a worker in a Fayetteville, North Carolina Olive Garden was forced to work with hepatitis because she earned that $2.13 wage, had to live on tips, and didn't have paid sick days. And 3,000 people in that county had to be called in by the county health department to get tested and ultimately ended up suing the company and won. There was also that same year 2 norovirus outbreaks in Olive Gardens in Indiana and Illinois. So we see outbreaks, especially of norovirus, incredibly common and really originating in restaurants and due to sick restaurant workers.
This series of outbreaks at Chipotle seems to me that it's going to change so much. Have you heard independent restaurateurs talking about just doing all this voluntarily because they're starting to understand the risk involved?
Absolutely. A lot of employers are voluntarily moving to the high road, providing these benefits and better wages because they're seeing consumers really like it. They're seeing less turnover from their workers, obviously less illness, just so many benefits from providing paid sick days and higher wages and other benefits.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Saru.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Saru Jayaraman has a new book out in February called Forked: A New Standard for American Dining. Up next, Jonathan Gold takes us to Leona in Venice. Stay close.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is here. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And today, we're off to Leona, a new restaurant devoted to California cuisine that's the brainchild of Top Chef alum Nyesha Arrington.
And, you know, she's been in different places. She worked for Josiah Citrin at Melisse for a while, and she was at that really odd steakhouse, Wilshire, in Santa Monica for a while, a steakhouse where people seem to order everything but steak. And this is her first restaurant of her own, I think.
Which is really great. A lot of us have been waiting for this.
Yeah, and it seems really to have settled the neighborhood nicely. It's a tough reservation. People seem to be generally glad to be there. She calls what she's doing California progressive cuisine. So there's hibiscus cured hamachi with shiso leaf that's, you know, something like something you'd be really, really happy to get at one of the millions of poke restaurants that's popping up. And she does like house-made cheese, which is like a Lebnik kind of. It's a thick, yogurty cheese with these really seedy crackers that she makes herself and like scraps of honeycomb, you know, oozing honey and some watercress. You sort of assemble it.
That sounds really delicious for an appetizer to me.
Yeah. She's really farmer's market oriented. So you get the crudité plate, which a lot of people are doing now. You don't find precisely what you would think you would find on it. I mean, you'll find like, you know, the usual like Weiser carrots, and you'll find cherry tomatoes and radishes and that sort of things. But there's also carrot fronds usually. There'll be that sort of leafy part of the inner celery bunch that you usually just throw away.
That's like my favorite part to eat.
It's kind of delicious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's super celery.
And some of her emphasis is using all of the vegetable, of not throwing anything away, which is, you know, like the thing that Massimo Bottura and Dan Barber are trying to do.
What were some of your favorite dishes that you had there?
The dish that most impressed me, and this will probably surprise everybody, is a squash entree.
You're going to the dark side, Jonathan.
I probably am. I've had it a couple ways with different squash. The last time was with a dumpling squash, which is – they look like thrown Mexican terracotta pots kind of with like stripes on them that were roasted, I believe – whole. I mean, top was cut off and the bottom was cut off so it would sit on the plate. It wasn't peeled and nobody scooped out the seeds and like the schmutz around the seeds. It was just a squash on a plate. There was a little burrata like smushed on the top and some crispy quinoa. But you're dealing with like whole squash. And I've never seen that in all my years.
Did you eat the seeds? Did you scoop them out and then just leave them on the side?
I figured that you were meant to eat it, right? You know, in the oven, the seeds steamed inside the squash, so they were pleasant to eat. And there was a little bit of sliminess to it, which she actually accentuated by putting tapioca pearls in with it. I mean, she wasn't trying to diminish the fact that there were the seeds and those weird stringy things holding the seeds in there. I thought it was the like equivalent of, you know, Chris at Yen Ben Rumi at Night Market serving like a blood soup. I mean, it's like sort of a vegetable throwing down. It's vegetable transgression. And I kind of dug it.
Did you fall in love with any of the meat entrees?
She has wonderful meatballs that she makes mostly with beef heart, which turns out to be something that you want to make meatballs with. I mean, there must have been some fat in there. There must have been something, some emulsifier. But they had that bounciness that's been bred out of most domestic meatballs. As you know, you find it in almost every meatball in Italy.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of heart, which has that that very resilient texture,
right?
I think of it as the opposite of like a yielding meatball.
Yeah, this isn't yielding. I mean, you cut through the knife and it's a clean cut. It doesn't crumble. It's not emulsified the way that a Chinese meatball would be. I was impressed with it. It comes with like little plantain chips and some sweet potatoes. There's sweet potatoes everywhere.
So before we got on air, we just happened to be talking about aligot, this very particular French bouncy string puree of potatoes and cheese.
Aligot is so good. It's this like really specific dish from the Auvergne, right? It's potatoes pureed with the curds of Cantal cheese, like classically, which are hard to find in Paris, much less here. And you whip them and you whip them and you whip them until you develop all that potato starch. And you put a spoon into a pan of it and you bring it up to serve it. And the entire pan seems almost to like bounce out of there with you.
Yeah, it would be what a food stylist would say would be like the perfect cheese pull for pizza or something.
Oh, yeah, exactly the perfect cheese pull. And they do a fantastic version at Spago. They serve with the Côte de Bœuf. Anyway, they do one at Leona that is supplemented somehow that I can't figure out with cauliflower. So there's a little bit of the taste, a little bit of the aroma, but mostly what you're getting is sort of the creaminess and the springiness of this wonderful starch and cheese.
Wow. I mean, it's this sounds like really a great place to go.
Yeah, it's really nice. And I love the lentils. It's one of the best dishes of lentils in town, you know, cooked to like that perfect thing where you can feel every individual lentil in your tongue, but they're still like super soft. And in bearing with the not wasting anything, it comes topped with a pesto made with radish tops.
They're delicious. There's no reason to throw those things away.
It's a menu that like a real like cook would have to come up with. And if you're going there, you should probably get the salted chocolate lavender bar, which is like a shortbread with ganache sprinkled with lavender blossoms and Maldon salt, which sounds strange but tastes so good.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Leona in Venice. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Jillian Ferguson, Abby Fentress-Swanson, Camelia Tse, Laryl Garcia, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.